Welcome to BridgeEd, the podcast brought to you by The Bridge here at Wellington College, where we'll be joined by a series of interesting guests to explore some of the most topical issues in the education sector.
Kevin House, I'm really happy that you're here with us again today. So interesting that you talk about time, because that was actually the subject of our last session with Patrick, and talking about the ways in which, in the world in which we live today, we experience intensification, fragmentation, acceleration.
And all of those create isolation.
Yes.
You know, the great trope of social media is it's connecting us anywhere, anytime, and it's absolutely not true. Because, yes, there are certain things that technology can act as a proxy for in the relational space, but the somatic, the energy field between you and I having a live conversation in this room now means it's a completely different interaction to you and I doing it on a screen. It can act as a proxy, particularly with, I would argue, with the adult mind, which is far more fully formed, but it does not work with children. Where you've got the architecture of a being that is still in far, far more in emergence than entropy. And that emergence needs space, but it also needs the energy of somatic connectivity with people. And that's why you see really such wonderful things happening in early childhood, that really the educators in a senior school context find themselves, those that are intuitive and intellectual enough to see that balance, finding themselves perennially frustrated by those extrinsic realities of the institution they're having to work in, whereas they can see in many contexts the relational component that their students want and cannot have because there's no time. And again, you know, that's a very difficult thing for educators to try and navigate.
There's an image I have in my head, or a word really, that I feel is missing from that that technologically driven reality, in whether it's in a classroom or not, and that is that it there's no movement. If you think about the sort of experience in early years education and the relationships and the possibility for discovery and exploration and process, it's always connected to movement, which we limit as we go forward. It doesn't mean that later on in a child's career they're not going to sport. You know, they are, and we know that sports are important and we have to have a healthy body and all of that, but we deny movement in many portions of our day.
Yeah, and I would say the same about song, movement and song. You look at most indigenous cultures, those are very, very core components. Dialogue, coming together, community, but also movement and song and ritual. And of course, those exist in our cultures, but many of them have been regulated and institutionalized to the point at which they're no longer... They no longer have, if you like, the jazz component, right? So they can't go where they may go. In an expressive sense, they've become highly regulated. You think about our sports, they're very regulated, institutionalized, very linear in that you do a sport and there's a certain outcome. And, you know, education tries to play with the idea of celebrating participation. But again, you look at all of the celebratory components of it and the rituals, it tends to be competitive, and it's reinforcing a different set of narratives, I think, rather than movement. It's about the hierarchies that we have in our qualification environments in schools, for example. And I think, yeah, look, that the movement piece for me, I think, is something I really think is hugely important. And going back to your point with the media, the media and the engagement with media, I think what I wanted to reflect on was the judgment, yesterday on Meta and Google in the US, where they, for the first time ever, you know, an individual has taken them on and got a judgment from her peers that, yes, her life was made significantly worse by a technology being released on her as a young child and into her adolescence that was detrimental to her health.
And, you know, I was looking at that this morning also, and you know, the fact that it, you know, it is designed deliberately to be addictive and it is exploitative, and I don't think that comes as a surprise to anyone. But how do we free ourselves of that?
Yeah, and I think, look, the important thing in the judgment really is I hope it's the beginning, as some are saying, of a snowball effect. Because, of course, the people behind the development of it, so the Meta, I think, is 20, 22 years old. They actively went out and used the game theory from gambling to create the algorithms, and were quite happy to release this on 8, 9, 10, 12, 13-year-olds for the generation of what? Under the trope of connectivity, but realistically to create more extraction and what's become known as attention capital to basically generate wealth. And it really was nothing to do with about creating human connectivity.
Well, and generate wealth, as you said earlier, for a small number.
But there will be people in that industry who did think genuinely what they were doing was doing a good thing, what they were trying to achieve in that connectivity. I'm sure there were people who genuinely believed that. And it comes from a position of care. And the point I want to make with that is that the chap I mentioned, who has become a good friend of mine, Luke Roberts, who I really encourage you to get on the podcast, because his insights into systems in institutions, as I said, like hospitals, prisons and schools, is that really we... And he's quite provocative in this space, in that he's suggested, for example, even very collegial and evaluative school review frameworks come from a position of care. But when you take a concept that comes from a place of care, many times deep care, and you place it into a system that is fundamentally extractive, it becomes a form of systemic violence. And I think that's the same with the media. Many of the people who worked to develop those tools, I think genuinely believe this would make life better for many, many human beings. But it hasn't played out like that, because really what's it done? It's amplified many of the extractive practices that exist in our cultures. And it really has just become a tool for that extraction. So even when you work from a position of care, you have to be mindful of what are you putting that concept or that idea into, and how might that play out? Not in a deterministic way, trying to future think how it will play out, but in an emergent way, saying this could go a multiplicity of different ways. And I need to be nimble and mindful of that. And I need to work with the people to help us come up with a collective understanding of that.
I'm thinking about how, you know, in the 90s that many of us felt that this connectivity was something that would support democracy.
Yes.
And ironically, it has done the opposite.
Yes. Because we thought, and this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, we thought communication was community. But communication is being with others. And I know you and I have talked about this with your Quakerism, right? For example, I've always been really curious of that wonderful ritual in the Friends of coming together in silence. And if you feel moved to speak, you have the space to speak. But that's a completely unregulated space where you're just being in a space with others.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment, I'm doing a leadership course over the course of the year with a chap called Peter Merry, and it's called Leading from the Field. And it's based around 12 principles of the field being the energy field. And some people go, oh, this is getting a bit, bit out there for me. But I'm kind of in that space where I'm like, we are so many more ways of knowing than I understood through my basically intellectual endeavors, because I found a happy place at some point in my life where I liked the institutions of learning in university and research. But I've come to realize that's only part of who I am. And I think I'm also beginning to realize I've not nourished the intuitive side of myself. And so the leading from the field is me exploring that space, particularly in my role, and the leadership component of that is how do I better understand the energy in the room?
Yeah, it's interesting because if you start speaking with people about the different kinds of silence, you may get an odd look, you know.
Yeah.
But there is an energy there that is palpable, and one can express it, you know, after having experienced it. But when you're talking about that, the space of friends, you know, and speaking out of silence, and it is an open and unregulated space in many ways, except there is the expectation that if you are moved to speak, it is a gift, and that it is in the interest of the collective. And I think that is very much related to some of the other things you've been talking about, and particularly an absence in some ways in the Western world, or a different understanding of what being in community can really mean, and that it's not about what one takes from, but what one gives to.
And that, I think, that's a lovely example of the gift, because the gift is a really important symbol. The gift is something you give, but the gift is also something you receive. And there needs to be an open-heartedness on both sides for that to work. If the open-heartedness for the receipt is not there, it becomes an imposition. And I think one of the really interesting things to bring it back to teaching, and the idea that many colleagues perhaps listening to our conversation are going, energy, hold on, that's going a bit too far for me. I would say, you know, in your heart, intuitively, when you go into a meeting and there's an energy in the room, you know, as a teacher, when you go into a classroom, if there's an energy in the room, but because of the time and motion dictates, you do not create space for that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as a good teacher knows when there's, for example, if there's, even in a class of 36 kids, you know if there's pain or suffering in that room. You may not know where it is, but you'll know it's there. But your curriculum and what you have to get through means you won't create the space for that. And I'm not suggesting every lesson becomes that. I think it's more like something like Ron Berger and the notion of being teacher as artisan, and that you listen to the intuitive part of what you are as a teacher. And I think the wonderful thing about teachers is those that are really, I would say, master practitioners have that balance between their intellectual capacity, their leadership and management, their coaching and mentorship skills, but their intuitive side of themselves. And it's a joy to watch a teacher like that work.
And it's in that intuitive side of things that you you find the kind of quality human interaction and communication that I would like to think should really be at the foundation of everything we do in our classrooms.
Yeah, and I want to be, and I mentioned it earlier, but I want to be really practical. If you look at K-12 education and you look at it from the point of view of scales, what's the scale of my relationships? My wife's a primary practitioner, and she once used what I think is a beautifully poetic way of describing what she does. She says, I get 25 kids at the beginning of the year and I've got 25 beautiful puzzles and I have a whole year to try and work out those puzzles. Obviously, I was a high school teacher and I'm like, I got 250. I just don't have the bandwidth to understand those beautiful puzzles. So there is a practical institutional difference there in the kinds of relationships that you can have. And the challenge, I would say, once it starts to scale, because of the disciplinary nature of our curricula in senior schools, is how do we create space, genuine space, to have more relational capacity and interaction with your students in authentic ways. And I mean authentic because they're emergent. You're not trying to determine them. You know, classic example would be PSHE curricula, right? And mindfulness sessions and various other things where I always remember we were doing a review with our students and one school had their well-being initiative, and this is, you know, 10 years ago, and he said, as we were talking about how his learning was and what he was enjoying and what he wasn't enjoying and what does good learning look like, you know, very Hattie-esque approach. And he said, oh, one of my frustrations at the moment is last year I had more study time and now they've taken two of those away for me to do well-being and mindfulness. He said, oh, I'm stressed about doing well-being and mindfulness. And I thought, that's a classic example of doing something from a place of care and putting it into the rigors of a time and space institutional practice that really dominates a worldview based on outcome. And of course, nobody intended it to play out for him like that. But I think maybe that resonates with many people who will be listening, is that you want to do these great things, but you're so time poor and your children are so time poor that these things
backfire. Yeah, but there's something else in that too, that, you know, it's the compartmentalization of things. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you spoke earlier about you know, transdisciplinary or, you know, a provocation and then you explore using various disciplinary approaches or methodologies. And I'm absolutely for that. And yet, you know, there are these core elements that we say are so important to us, well-being, or, I mean, it could be all kinds of things. Or for a school, it's global citizenship, or it's, you know, whatever. And so we make a thing. So we're going to make a time for this thing. Yes. But we're already time poor. And we're already struggling with the very concept of transdisciplinarity because the whole system, you know, as it's set up, is compartmentalized. So we lose meaning, actually. And I'm not really surprised by the stressfulness of the mindfulness. I think I would feel it myself. But it is, you know, if there is something that you feel should mark the experience of a child in their life at school, then you find ways to weave it into their life at school, not to set up that little time that's for whatever and then it's forgotten because it's unconnected to everything else.
Yeah, and I think you remind me of something I'd like to just briefly touch on, going back to regenerative education and the vision that we had at Green School and how it might play out in a very specific Green School context, because Green School is a quite a special environment in that they do prioritise a number of things, rituals, community, in ways that I've not seen in other school contexts. And it's not saying it's better or worse, it's more that it's a different way of doing it. But with the process of what we were calling a regenerative education, we began with what I talked about earlier, which was the social constructivism around inquiry and transdisciplinarity, which is very well socialized these days, not always endorsed, seen as progressive in some contexts. But nonetheless, people generally understand what you're getting at. I think what I drew from the Ecology of Mind and Gregory Bateson's work was really transcontextuality. And what it started to make me think about in schooling is actually it's not just about how concepts play out differently across disciplines. So you can take a key concept and play it out in different disciplines, and it will emerge in different ways. But what you're trying to do is that term of making the learning sticky for the students, so they go, oh, this concept actually works in language arts as well as in philosophy or in physics or in mathematics. But I think also transcontextuality. So in other words, a concept in a different context plays out differently. And to your point, the rigors of the timetable, imagine a world where we could have more flexibility, that certain things that you want to live in that timetable were slightly more fluid and could happen in different contexts and possibly at different times than is necessarily laid out in the timetable. What if the timetable is just a way marker? It's not a, dare I say, a prison, that everything has to happen at a certain time within that. We could have scheduling that allowed for a little bit more flexibility, a little bit more fluidity in terms of the management of time and context, so that transcontextual was a key part of what we were doing with Janisch Education. So we had broadly a number of threads. There was transdisciplinarity, transcontextuality, but also looking at restorative practice and peace. Very honoured to say, a friend of mine, Hilary Kremen, her work around restorative justice and peace. And I think that's, again, a very key component of this as a compass point. If peace is always at the back of your mind in what you're trying to do in education, I think that's an easily forgotten element. And I don't mean that in a kind of United Nations version of peace. I think peace more is a deeper communal reality for us as a species. We want peace. Peace is where our families thrive, we thrive. Inevitably, conflict comes up, but it's always to get back to a point of peace. And I don't think we prioritize that enough in education, particularly in education systems that prioritize competition. And almost in some contexts, even from a position of care, acts of violence or acts of aggression within that competitive matrix, as opposed to saying, how do we get a balance with peace? So with Green Schools, we were doing a lot of work with that in community.
I just keep coming back in my own mind to that tension between the individual and the collective.
Mm.
And that in so many ways, when we're setting aims for, you know, or trying to define what we think the purpose of education should be, that if we bring back whatever it is to the experience of the individual rather than trying to promote a shared experience for the collective that is positive, then we're always going to struggle.
Yeah, I'm in the middle of writing a chapter for dual volume publication, I think, with Eri Mountbatten O'Malley, who's at Bar Spa and does a lot of great work with World Cafe and Flourishing Cafe, and is working with some colleagues in UK and in US, I think, with Harvard, around global flourishing goals. And he said, would you like to contribute? And I said, yeah, I'd love to, but I am going to critique the notion of a flourishing goal. And he's a lovely guy and said, yeah, we want critical dialogue and debate around it. And I think it's a step in the right direction. It's a bit like SDGs, because for me, the SDGs were about sustainability. We need to be going beyond sustainability to restorative. In a planetary sense, we need to be restorative. And the end point, if you look at RSA and their regenerative narrative, you know, you need to go from extractive to sustainable to restorative to regenerative. So in other words, how do we get to a cyclical sense of balance, us as a species amongst species on a living planet, and get to that regenerative space? It's all connected. And I think flourishing is the same. And so my chapter is really looking at, well, how do we go beyond global flourishing goals and reach some space in which we have a better understanding of what restorative flourishing means in that individual and communal reality and planetary reality. Because one of the things I wanted to do, if I ever got the time, was I wanted to reinvent PSHE to call it PPHE, which is, I know I've bored you with it before, but personal and planetary health education. Because for me, personal health, you will not have that unless you have planetary health. We're seeing that. Lifetime, we're living it now. Our rising anxiety and well-being crisis is a direct correlation with the planetary crisis. The planet is not well, and we're a component part of that. We may be one of the key reasons for it. But until we try to find a way back to getting more balance and restorative and regenerative living, we are going to continually suffer anxiety and existential crisis and mental health issues, I believe.
I think we're going to have to leave it.
Yes.
On that note, which one could say is a little bit overwhelming.
But there is always hope.
Yes.
There is always hope.
And I believe very strongly that it's essential that we speak more about ecosystems, if we speak more about humanity as a part of something much larger, about the interconnectedness, then we may be able to do things that are better.
It reminds me, there's a parting comment. I remember being really, really moved by John Gray's Straw Dogs 25 years ago. And many people say that as a political philosopher, he's a pessimist. And I know John pushes back against that, and I would agree with him, because there really his hypothesis is that there is a kind of planetary status quo for our species, potentially. And we have gone way, way beyond that. And when I say there is hope, we will always be here. I do not buy into it's the end of humanity. We will always be here. We will be here in a different guise. We've been here for thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years. And we will still be here, but it will look very different than it looks today. And it's our inability to be able to see that. And of course, why would we be able to see that? But I think many of our kin, and that notion of kinship in indigenous knowledge systems, our kin in those worlds know that we'll still be here. It will just look very different.
Well, Kevin, thank you. I think there's so much more we could talk about. We may have to have you come back. But it's been great.
Always a pleasure to meet and spend time with you.
And I'm really excited to hear what sort of responses we might get from our listeners, because there's a lot to be pulled apart there. So thank you.
And always happy to chat. If anyone listens and wants to reach out, always happy to chat. This is important work. Education is important work. We are the nest. We nurture the future. And that's a huge honor and a huge privilege. And we all do it together.
Okay. Thank you.
Please leave a comment, ask a question, and like, follow, and subscribe to hear more from Bridge Ed. You can also follow The Bridge on LinkedIn. And you can find out more information on our website at thebridge.wellingtoncollege.org.uk. Until next time.